The Castle by Franz Kafka, continued. Disc 2. K was hesitant to give his name. Against the telephone he was defenceless. The person could shout him down, lay down the mouthpiece, and K would have blocked a path that was perhaps not insignificant. K's hesitation made the man impatient. "Who's there?" he repeated, adding, "I should be greatly pleased if less use were made of the telephone there. Someone telephoned only a moment ago." K did not reply to this remark, and announced with sudden resolve, "This is the assistant of the gentleman who came as surveyor."
"What assistant? What gentleman? What surveyor?"
K recalled yesterday's telephone conversation. "Ask Fritz," he said curtly. It worked, to his own astonishment. Yet what amazed him even more than its working was the consistency of the official service there. The response was, "I know. The Eternal Land Surveyor.
Yes, yes, go on. What assistant?"
"Joseph," said K. Having the peasants mumbling behind his back was somewhat annoying. They evidently disapproved of his not giving his right name. But K had no time to deal with them, for the conversation required all his attention.
"Joseph," came the reply. "The assistants are called..."
A short pause. He was apparently asking somebody else for their names.
"Artur and Jeremiah."
"Those are the new assistants," said K.
"No, those are the old ones."
"Those are the new ones. I'm the old one who came today to join the surveyor."
"No!"
the voice was now shouting. "Who am I, then?" K asked, as calmly as before. And after a pause, the same voice, which had the same speech defect, but sounded like a different, deeper, more imposing voice, said,
"You're the old assistant."
K was still listening to the sound of the voice, and almost missed the next question.
"What do you want?"
Most of all, he would have liked to put down the receiver. He was no longer expecting anything from this conversation. Only under pressure did he quickly add, "When can my master come to the castle?"
"Never,"
came the answer. "Fine," said K, replacing the receiver. Behind him, the peasants had already edged up extremely close to him. The assistants, who kept casting side glances at him, were busy keeping the peasants away. But this seemed no more than a comedy, and the peasants, satisfied with the outcome of the conversation, gradually yielded. Just then their group was divided in two by a man who came from behind in rapid stride, bowed before Kay, and handed him a letter. Kay held the letter in his hand and looked at the man, who seemed more important to him just then. He greatly resembled the assistants, was as slender as they, just as lightly dressed, had the same quickness and agility, and yet he was quite different. If only Kay could have had him as an assistant. He reminded Kay somewhat of the woman with the infant whom he had seen at the Master Tanner's. He was dressed almost entirely in white. The material could scarcely be silk. It was winter clothing like all the rest, but it had the delicacy and formality of silk. His face was bright and open, with enormous eyes. His smile was uncommonly encouraging. He brushed his hand across his face as though trying to chase away the smile, but he didn't succeed. "Who are you?" asked Kay.
"My name is Barnabas," he said. "I am a messenger."
As he spoke, his lips opened and closed in a masculine but gentle way.
"How do you like it here?"
asked Kay, pointing to the peasants, who still hadn't lost interest in him, and who, with their bulging lips, open mouths, and almost tortured faces, their heads looked as if they had been beaten flat on top and their features shaped in the pain of the beating, were staring at him, but then again not staring at him, since their eyes sometimes wandered off and rested a while on some indifferent object before returning to him. And then Kay pointed to the assistants, who were embracing each other, cheek to cheek, and smiling. Whether in humility or mockery, one could not tell. He pointed all this out as if introducing an entourage forced on him by special circumstances, in the hope, this suggested familiarity, which was what mattered to Kay, that Barnabas had the sense to tell the difference between these people and Kay. Yet Barnabas completely ignored this, though in all innocence, as one could see, letting the question pass, just like a well-trained servant faced with a comment only seemingly addressed to him by his master, and in response to the question merely looked about, greeting his acquaintances among the peasants with a wave and exchanging a few words with the assistants, all this freely and independently, without mingling with them. Rejected but not abashed, Kay turned to the letter in his hand and opened it. It read as follows. "Dear Sir, as you know, you have been accepted into the Count's service. Your immediate superior is the village council chairman.
He will furnish you with all further details concerning your work and terms of employment, and you, in turn, will be accountable to him. Nevertheless, I too shall keep you in mind. Barnabas, who brings you this letter, will occasionally call on you to ascertain your wishes and relay them to me. You will find that I am always ready, in so far as possible, to oblige you. Having satisfied workers is important to me. The signature wasn't legible, but printed beside it were the words, "The Director of Bureau Number 10. "Wait," Kay told Barnabas, who was bowing. Then he asked the landlord to show him his room, since he wanted to spend some time alone with the letter. At the same time, it occurred to him that regardless of his affection for Barnabas, he was merely a messenger, so he had them bring him a beer. He observed him to see how he would accept it. He accepted it with seeming eagerness and drank it right away. Then Kay left with the landlord. In that little house, they had only been able to prepare a small attic room for Kay, and even that had caused problems, for the two maids who had slept there until then had had to be lodged elsewhere. Actually, they had only moved out the maids. Aside from that, the room was probably unchanged. There were no sheets on the one bed, just a few pillows and a horse blanket left in the same state as everything else after last night. On the wall there were a few saints' pictures and photographs of soldiers. The room hadn't even been aired. They were evidently hoping that the new guest wouldn't stay long and did nothing to keep him. Yet Kay agreed to everything, wrapped himself in the blanket, sat down at the table, and in the light of a candle began to read the letter again. It wasn't consistent. Some passages treated him as a free man and conceded that he had a will of his own, such as the initial greeting and the passage concerning his wishes. There were other passages, though, that treated him openly or indirectly as a lowly worker who was barely noticeable from the director's post. The director had to make an effort to keep him in mind. His superior was only the village chairman, to whom he was even accountable. His only colleague was perhaps the village policeman. Undoubtedly these were contradictions, so obvious they must be intentional. The thought, a crazy one in the case of such authorities, that indecision might have played a role here, scarcely occurred to Kay. He saw it more as a choice that had been freely offered him. It had been left up to him to decide what he wanted to make of the provisions in the letter, whether he wanted to be a village worker with a distinctive but merely apparent connection to the castle, or an apparent village worker who in reality allowed the messages brought by Barnabas to define the terms of his position. Kay did not hesitate to choose, nor would he have hesitated to do so even if he had never had certain experiences here. It was only as a village worker, as far from the castle gentleman as possible, that he could achieve anything at the castle. These people in the village who were so distrustful of him would start talking as soon as he had become, if not their friend, then their fellow citizen. And once he had become indistinguishable from, say, Gerstacker or Lazeman, this must happen very quickly, everything depended on it, all those paths would suddenly open up, which, if he were to rely solely on the gentlemen above, on their good graces, would always remain blocked off and invisible, too. Yet there was certainly a risk, and the letter stressed this and even dwelled on it with a certain delight, as though it were inevitable. It was his status as a worker. Service, superior, work, terms of employment, accountable, workers. The letter was crammed with such terms, and even if it referred to other, more personal matters, it did so from the same point of view. If Kay wanted to become a worker, he could become one, but then only in dreadful earnest, without any prospects anywhere else. Kay knew that there was no threat of actual compulsion. He had no fear of that, especially not here. But the force of these discouraging surroundings and of the increasing familiarity with ever more predictable disappointments, the force of scarcely perceptible influences at every moment, these he certainly did fear. But even in the face of this danger, he had to risk taking up the struggle. Indeed, the letter made no secret of the fact that if it came to a struggle, Kay was the one who had been reckless enough to start. This was delicately put, and could only have been noticed by a troubled conscience. Troubled, not bad. Namely, the three words, "as you know," concerning his being accepted into the castle's service. Kay had announced his presence, and ever since then he had known, as the letter put it, that he was accepted. Kay took a picture from the wall and hung the letter on the nail. This is where he would be living, so the letter should hang here. Then he went down to the taproom. Barnabas was sitting at a small table with the assistants. "Ah, there you are," said Kay, for no reason, simply because he was glad to see Barnabas. He jumped up at once. Kay had no sooner entered than the peasants rose to get close to him. They had already formed the habit of following him about constantly. "What is it you always want from me?" cried Kay.
They did not take offence and slowly withdrew to their places. As one of them walked off, he said casually with an indecipherable smile, which several others adopted, "One always gets to hear some news," and he licked his lips as if the news were edible. Kay didn't say anything conciliatory to him. It was good if they learned to respect him, but no sooner was he seated beside Barnabas than he felt a peasant's breath down the back of his neck. The peasant said he had come for the salt shaker, but Kay stumped his foot in anger, and the peasant ran off without the salt shaker. It was really easy to get the better of Kay. One simply needed, say, to set the peasants on him. Their stubborn concern seemed more malicious to him than the aloofness of the others, and it, too, was a form of aloofness, for if Kay had sat down at their table, they would certainly not have remained seated. Only Barnabas's presence prevented him from making a commotion. Nonetheless, he swung around menacingly toward them. They were also facing him. Yet seeing them sitting there like that, each one on his own chair, neither conversing with one another nor visibly connected, connected only because all of them were staring at him, it seemed to him that they weren't pursuing him out of malice. Perhaps they really wanted something from him, but just couldn't say what it was. And if that wasn't it, perhaps it was merely childlike behaviour on their part, the childlike quality that seemed very much at home here. Wasn't it also childlike of the landlord to be standing there, holding in both hands a glass of beer, which he should have taken to some guest, gazing at Kay and missing a cry from the landlady who had leaned out of the kitchen hatch? Calmer now, Kay turned to Barnabas. He would have liked to remove the assistants, but couldn't find a pretext. Besides, they were staring silently at their beer. "I have read the letter," Kay began. "Do you know the contents?"
"No," said Barnabas.
His expression seemed to convey more than his words. Perhaps Kay was being mistakenly positive now, just as he had been mistakenly negative with the peasants, but the presence of Barnabas remained a source of comfort. "There is also talk of you in the letter. You must carry messages back and forth between me and the director. That's why I assumed you knew the contents." "I was simply instructed," Barnabas said, "to hand you the letter, wait until you had read it, and bring back a verbal or written reply, should you find this necessary."
"Fine," said Kay.
"No letter is required. Convey to the director. But what's his name? I couldn't read his signature."
"Clam," said Barnabas.
"Well then, convey my thanks to Mr. Clam for the acceptance, and also for his exceptional kindness, which I, as one who still hasn't proved himself here, certainly appreciate. I shall act entirely in accordance with his intentions. I have no special wishes for today." Barnabas, who had followed this closely, asked whether he could repeat the message in Kay's presence. Kay gave permission, and Barnabas repeated everything word for word. Then he stood up in order to take his leave. Throughout all this, Kay had been examining his face, and now did so one last time. Though Barnabas was about as tall as Kay, his eyes seemed to look down on Kay, but almost deferentially. It was inconceivable that this man could ever put anybody to shame. Of course, he was only a messenger and wasn't familiar with the contents of the letters he had to deliver, but his expression, his smile, his gait seemed to bear a message even if he himself was unaware of it. And Kay stretched out his hand, which clearly surprised Barnabas, for he had merely intended to bow. As soon as he had left, before opening the door, he had leaned against the door with his shoulder for a moment and looked around the tap room with a glance no longer directed at anyone in particular, Kay said to the assistants, "I shall get my notes from my room, then we'll discuss the next project." They wanted to go with him. "Stay here," said Kay. They still wanted to go with him. Kay had to repeat the command in a more severe tone of voice. Barnabas was no longer in the corridor, but he had just left. And yet, outside the inn, it was snowing again. Kay could not see him. He cried, "Barnabas!" No answer. Could he still be in the building? This seemed the only possibility. Nevertheless, with full force, Kay shouted out the name. The name thundered through the night. And from a distance a faint answer came, so Barnabas had already gone that far. Kay called him back as he went toward him. Where they met, they were no longer visible from the inn. "Barnabas," said Kay, unable to suppress a tremor in his voice, "there is something else I must tell you. I see now that this is actually quite a bad arrangement, my having to depend entirely on your chance appearances whenever I need anything from the castle. If I hadn't managed to catch you just now by chance, the speed at which you fly, I thought you were still at the inn. Who knows how long I should have had to wait before you came again?" "Well," said Barnabas, "you can ask the director to ensure that I always come at times set by you."
But that wouldn't do either, said Kay. Perhaps for a whole year I won't want to send any messages, and then only 15 minutes after you're gone, something that cannot be delayed.
Should I report to the director then, said Barnabas, that there needs to be another means of communication between him and you, other than through me?
No, no, said Kay, absolutely not. I'm only mentioning this in passing, for I had the good fortune to catch you just now.
Should we go back to the inn, said Barnabas, so that you can give me the new instructions? He already had taken a step toward the inn.
Barnabas, said Kay, that isn't necessary. I shall go part of the way with you.
Why don't you want to go to the inn? Asked Barnabas.
Those people there keep disturbing me, said Kay. You yourself have seen how intrusive those peasants are.
We can go to your room, said Barnabas.
It's the maid's room, said Kay. It's dirty and dank. I wanted to go a bit of the way with you, so I wouldn't have to stay there. Only, Kay added in an attempt to overcome Barnabas's hesitation, you must let me take your arm. Your footing is surer than mine.
Kay took his arm. It was quite dark. Kay couldn't see his face. His form was indistinct. A little while ago he had tried to grope about for his arm.
Barnabas gave in. They moved away from the inn.
Still, Kay felt that however hard he tried, he couldn't keep up with Barnabas, and was restricting his freedom of movement, and that a little thing like that could ruin everything, even under ordinary conditions, let alone in side streets like the one where Kay had sunk into the snow that morning, and from which he could extricate himself only if Barnabas lifted him out. Yet he put aside those worries for now. Besides, he found Barnabas's silence comforting. If they went on like this in silence, it meant that for Barnabas, too, the only reason for being together was to keep going. They went on. Where to, Kay had no idea. He couldn't recognize anything. Didn't even know whether they had passed the church. Due to the sheer effort of walking, he could no longer control his thoughts. Rather than remaining fixed on the goal, they became confused. His homeland kept surfacing, filling him with memories. On its main square, too, was a church, partly surrounded by an old cemetery, and it, in turn, by a high wall. Only very few boys had ever climbed this wall. Kay still hadn't succeeded either. It wasn't curiosity that drove them. The cemetery no longer held any secrets for them. They had often enough gone in through the small wrought-iron gate, and had merely wanted to conquer the smooth, high wall. And then one morning, the calm, empty square was flooded with light. When, before or since, had Kay ever seen it like this? He succeeded with surprising ease. At a spot where he had been often rebuffed, with a small flag clenched between his teeth, he climbed the wall on the first attempt. Pebbles were still trickling down, but he was on top. He rammed in the flag. The wind filled out the cloth. He looked down, all around, even over his shoulder at the crosses sinking into the earth. There was nobody here now bigger than he. By chance, the teacher came by, and with an angry look drove Kay down. In jumping off, Kay hurt his knee, and only with difficulty reached home. But still, he had been up on the wall. It had seemed to him then that this feeling of victory would sustain him throughout a long life, and this hadn't been entirely foolish, for now, after many years, on the arm of Barnabas in this snowy night, it came to his aid. He tightened his grip. Barnabas almost dragged him. The silence was not broken. Of this particular route, Kay could say only that by judging the state of the road, they had not yet turned off into a side street. He vowed not to let any difficulties along the way or worries about the way back keep him from going on, for after all, he surely had sufficient strength for being dragged along. And could this path be endless? All day the castle had lain before him like an easy goal, and this messenger certainly knew the shortest way. Just then Barnabas stopped. Where were they? Couldn't they go on? Would Barnabas send Kay on his way? He wouldn't succeed. Kay gripped Barnabas's arm so tightly that he almost hurt himself. Or might the incredible have happened, and they were already in the castle or at its gates? Yet so far as Kay knew, they still hadn't gone uphill. Or had Barnabas led him along such an imperceptibly rising path?
Where are we? Kay asked quietly, more to himself than to Barnabas.
Home, said Barnabas in the same tone.
Home?
Now take care, sir, that you don't slip. The path goes downhill.
Downhill?
Only another step or two, he added, and he was already knocking on a door. A girl opened it. They were now standing on the threshold of a large room that lay almost in darkness, for there was only a tiny oil lamp hanging over a table on the left toward the back.
Who is with you, Barnabas? The girl asked.
The surveyor, he said.
The surveyor!
Said the girl, repeating his answer more loudly in the direction of the table.
At that, two old people, a man and his wife, stood up, and a girl as well. They greeted Kay. Barnabas introduced him to everyone. It was his parents and his sisters, Olga and Amalia. Kay scarcely looked at them. They removed his wet coat to dry it by the stove. Kay let this happen. So it was not they who were at home, only Barnabas was at home. But why were they here? Kay took Barnabas aside and said, "Why did you go home? Or do you live in the castle precincts?" "In the castle precincts?" Barnabas repeated, as if he did not understand Kay. "Barnabas," said Kay, "you wanted to go from the inn to the castle." "No, sir," said Barnabas. "I wanted to go home. I only go to the castle in the morning. I never sleep there." "So," said Kay, "you didn't want to go to the castle, only as far as here." To Kay, his smile seemed fainter, and he himself more insignificant. "Why didn't you say so?" "You never asked, sir," said Barnabas. "You merely wanted to give me another message, but neither in the tap-room nor in your own room. So I thought you could give it to me here at my parents' house, without anybody disturbing you. They will go away at once, if that's the order you give. Besides, if you prefer to be with us, you can spend the night here. Haven't I done the right thing?" Kay was unable to answer. So it was a misunderstanding, a low, vulgar misunderstanding, and Kay had completely abandoned himself to it. He had let himself be spellbound by the shimmering, silky, tight-fitting jacket, which Barnabas now unbuttoned, revealing underneath a coarse, dirt-grey, often-mended shirt over the powerful square chest of a farmhand. And everything else was not only in keeping with this, but even outdid it. The old gout-ridden father, who moved more with the help of his groping hands than of his stiff, trailing legs, and the mother who, hands clasped on her breast, could, because of her girth, only take the tiniest of steps. Ever since he had entered, Barnabas's father and mother had been trying to approach him from their corner, but they were still nowhere near him. The sisters, blondes, who resembled each other and Barnabas too, though with harsher features than Barnabas, were big, strong country girls. They surrounded the new arrivals, expecting some greeting from Kay. Yet he couldn't say a word. He had been convinced that everyone in the village mattered to him, and this was probably true. But these people in particular meant absolutely nothing to him. If he could have managed the way back to the inn alone, he would have left at once. The possibility of going to the castle with Barnabas tomorrow morning did not tempt him at all. He had wanted to press on to the castle at night, unnoticed, led by Barnabas. But by Barnabas as he had struck him till now, a man who was closer to him than everyone else he had met here thus far, and who, so he had also believed then, possessed close connections with the castle, far exceeding his apparent rank. But as for the son of this family, who fully belonged to it, and already was sitting at the table with them, a man who significantly enough wasn't even allowed to sleep at the castle, to go arm in arm with him to the castle in broad daylight was impossible, a ridiculous, hopeless endeavour. Kay sat down on a window seat, determined to spend the night there and not to accept any other services from this family. The people in the village, who sent him away or at least feared him, were less dangerous, it seemed to him, since they essentially threw him back on his own resources and thus helped him to preserve his strength, whereas those seeming helpers who, instead of taking him to the castle, led him by means of a little masquerade to their family, distracted him, whether intentionally or not, and were draining all his strength. Completely ignoring an invitation from the family table, he remained on his window seat, with his head bent. Then Olga, the gentler of the two sisters, rose, came over, and with a touch of girlish embarrassment asked him to join them at the table. They had already put out bread and bacon. She would go to get beer. "But from where?" Kay asked. "From the inn," she said. Kay was pleased to hear this. He asked that instead of getting beer, she accompany him to the inn. Important tasks still awaited him there. It now turned out, though, that she did not want to go to his inn, only to one much closer by, to the gentleman's inn. Nonetheless, Kay asked whether he could accompany her. They might have a place for the night, he thought. No matter what it was like, he would rather have it than the best bed in this house. Olga did not answer at once. She glanced back at the table. Her brother stood up, nodded eagerly, and said, "If that's what the gentleman wants." This approval almost prompted Kay to withdraw his request. Anything that man could approve must be worthless. Yet when they brought up the question whether Kay would be admitted to the inn, and everyone doubted it, he insisted all the more urgently on going, though without troubling to invent a plausible reason for his request. This family had to accept him as he was. Somehow he had no shame where they were concerned. Only Amalia shook his confidence slightly in that respect with her grave, fixed, imperturbable, and perhaps rather dull gaze. On the short walk to the inn, Kay took Olga's arm and let himself be pulled. What else could he do, much as he had done earlier with her brother? He discovered that this inn was reserved exclusively for the castle gentlemen, who, whenever they had anything to do in the village, would eat and sometimes even spend the night there. Olga spoke with Kay, softly, and as if on familiar terms. It was pleasant walking with her, almost as pleasant as with her brother. Kay struggled against this sense of well-being, but it persisted. Outwardly, the inn was very similar to the inn where Kay was staying. There were hardly any great outward differences in the village, but one could detect certain minor differences right away. There was a balustrade on the front steps, and a handsome lantern attached over the door. As they entered, a cloth fluttered over their heads. It was a flag with the Count's colours. In the hallway, they immediately encountered the landlord, evidently on a tour of inspection. With small eyes, he looked quizzically or sleepily at Kay in passing and said, "The surveyor may go no farther than the tap-room." "Of course," said Olga, immediately taking Kay's side. "He only came with me." But Kay, ungrateful, let go of Olga and took the landlord aside. Meanwhile, Olga waited patiently at the end of the corridor. "I would like to spend the night here," said Kay. "Unfortunately, that's impossible," said the landlord. "You don't seem to realize yet that this house is reserved exclusively for the gentlemen from the castle."
"Well, that may be the regulation," said Kay, "but you can surely let me sleep in a corner somewhere."
"I should very much like to oblige you," said the landlord, "but, leaving aside the severity of the actual regulation, which you speak of in the manner of a stranger, that is simply impracticable, since the gentlemen are extremely sensitive. I am convinced that they cannot bear the sight of a stranger, or not without forewarning, at least. So if I let you spend the night here, and by chance, and chance is always on the gentleman's side, somebody were to come across you, not only would I be lost, but so too would you. This sounds ridiculous, but it's true."
This tall, rather reserved gentleman, who had one hand braced against the wall, the other on his hip, his legs crossed and body tilted slightly toward Kay, and was speaking to him in confidence, no longer seemed to belong in this village, though his suit was festive only by peasant standards.
"I believe you completely," said Kay, "and don't by any means underestimate the importance of the actual regulation, however clumsily I may have expressed myself. There's only one other thing to which I wish to draw your attention. I have valuable connections at the castle, and will obtain others that are even more valuable. These will shield you from any danger possibly arising from my overnight stay, and guarantee that I can express fitting gratitude for this small favour."
"I know," said the landlord, and then he repeated, "I know that."
Kay could have stated his wish more emphatically, but distracted by this particular response, he merely asked, "Are many gentlemen from the castle spending the night here?"
"In that respect, the situation tonight is quite favourable," the landlord said, almost enticingly. "Only one gentleman has stayed."
Kay still found it impossible to insist. He was hoping that by now he almost had permission to stay, so he simply asked for the gentleman's name.
"Clam," the landlord said casually, turning to his wife, who came rustling along dressed in clothes that were oddly threadbare, outmoded and laden with pleats and frills, but city finery nonetheless. She came to get the landlord. The director desired something. Before he left, the landlord turned to Kay, as though the decision about the overnight stay no longer rested with him, but with Kay. Kay, however, was unable to say a word. Especially surprising to him was the presence of his superior. Unable to explain this to himself, he felt that he couldn't deal as freely with Clam as he generally did with the castle, and though it wouldn't have been as terrifying as the landlord assumed if Clam had caught him there, it would nonetheless have led to an awkward unpleasantness, as if he had, say, frivolously inflicted suffering on someone he was indebted to. Yet it still oppressed him greatly to see that the consequences he feared, such as his being a subordinate, a worker, were becoming evident, and that he couldn't overcome them even here, where they were so blatant. He stood thus, silently biting his lips. Before disappearing into a doorway, the landlord looked back at him again. Kay stared after him and did not move from the spot until Olga came and pulled him away.
"What did you want from the landlord?" asked Olga.
"I wanted to spend the night here," said Kay.
"But you're spending the night with us," said Olga in astonishment.
"To be sure," said Kay, leaving it to her to interpret the words he had spoken. Chapter 3. Frida.
In the taproom, large but empty in the middle, there were a few peasants along the walls, leaning against barrels or sitting on them, but they looked different from the people at Kay's inn. The ones here were more neatly and uniformly dressed in a coarse grey-yellow material with bulky jackets and tight-fitting trousers. Small men. At first glance, they seemed quite alike, with their flat, bony, yet round-cheeked faces. All were quiet and barely moved, except to train their eyes on the new arrivals, slowly and indifferently. Still, because they were so numerous and because it was so silent, they had a certain effect on Kay. He took Olga's arm again to let these people know why he was here. In a corner, a man, an acquaintance of Olga's, rose and was about to approach them, but with her linked arm Kay turned her in another direction. She alone could notice this, and she accepted it with a smiling side glance at him. The beer was served by a young girl called Frida, a nondescript little blonde with sad features, thin cheeks, and a surprising gaze, a gaze of exceptional superiority. When this gaze descended on Kay, it seemed to him to be a gaze that had already decided matters concerning him, whose existence he himself still knew nothing about, but of whose existence that gaze now convinced him. Kay kept watching Frida from the side, even while she spoke with Olga. Olga and Frida didn't seem to be friends, they merely exchanged a few cold words. Kay wanted to help them out, so he asked abruptly, "Do you know Mr. Clam?" Olga burst out laughing. "Why are you laughing?" Kay asked irritably. "But I'm not laughing," she said, though she kept on laughing. "Olga is still a rather childish girl," said Kay, bending down over the counter so as to draw Frida's gaze firmly back toward him. But she kept her eyes lowered and said softly, "Do you want to see Mr. Clam?" Kay said yes. She pointed to a door right beside her on the left. "Here's a little peephole. You can look through here." "And what about these people?" asked Kay. She pouted out her lower lip and, with an uncommonly soft hand, pulled Kay to the door. Through the small hole, which evidently had been drilled for the purpose of observation, he could almost see the entire room next door. At a desk in the centre, on a comfortable armchair, sat Mr. Clam, harshly illuminated by a light bulb hanging in front of him. A medium-sized, fat, ponderous gentleman. His face was still smooth, but his cheeks had begun to sag a little under the weight of the years. His black moustache stuck out on the sides. A precariously balanced pince-nez, which reflected the light, concealed his eyes. Had Mr. Clam been sitting directly facing the desk, Kay would have seen only his profile, but since Clam was turned straight toward him, he had a full view of his face. Clam had put his left elbow on the desk, and his right hand, which held a Virginia cigar, was resting on his knee. On the desk was a beer glass. Since the desk had a high rim, Kay could not see clearly whether there were any documents lying there, but to him the desk seemed empty. In order to make sure, he asked Frida to look through the hole and tell him what she saw. But since she had just been in the room, she could confirm right away that there were no documents lying there. Kay asked Frida whether he had to leave now, but she said he could look as long as he wanted. Now Kay was alone with Frida. Olga, he fleetingly noted, had indeed found her way to her acquaintance and sat high up on a barrel, kicking her feet. "Frida," said Kay in a whisper, "do you know Mr. Clam very well?" "Oh, yes," she said, "very well." She leaned over next to Kay, playfully arranging her blouse, which, as Kay only now noticed, was a thin, low-cut, cream-coloured garment, hanging like a foreign object from her poor body. Then she said, "Don't you remember how Olga laughed?" "Yes, the rude thing," said Kay. "Well," she said in a conciliatory tone, "there was cause for laughter. You asked whether I know Clam. Actually, I'm..." At this point she involuntarily straightened up a little, and her victorious gaze, which had absolutely nothing to do with the conversation, passed over Kay again. "Actually, I'm his mistress." "Clam's mistress," said Kay. She nodded. "Well," said Kay, smiling, so that things wouldn't get too serious between them, "then I consider you a very respectable person." "You're not alone in that," Frida said affably, though without returning his smile. Kay had a means of combating this arrogance and employed it by asking, "Have you ever been at the castle?" But this didn't work, for she responded, "No, but isn't it sufficient that I'm here in the taproom?" Her ambition was obviously boundless, and it was on Kay, apparently, that she sought to appease it. "Of course," said Kay. "Here in the taproom it is you who does the landlord's work." "That's true," she said, "and I began as a stable maid at the Bridge Inn." "With those delicate hands?" said Kay, half quizzically, not knowing whether he was merely flattering her or had himself really been conquered by her. Her hands were indeed small and delicate, but they could also be called weak and expressionless. "Nobody paid any attention to that then," she said, "and even now." Kay looked at her quizzically. She shook her head and broke off. "Of course," said Kay, "you have your secrets and aren't about to tell them to someone you've only known for half an hour, someone who still hasn't even had a chance to tell you about his situation." This remark proved inopportune. It was as if he had awakened Frieda from a slumber favourable to him. She took from the leather bag hanging from her belt a small wooden stick, stopped the peephole with it, and said to Kay, clearly checking herself so that he wouldn't notice the change in her attitude, "As for you, I know all about you. You're the surveyor." And then she added, "But I must get back to work now." And she went to her place behind the counter, while here and there several of the people rose to get their empty glasses refilled. Kay wanted to speak with her again, unobtrusively, so he took an empty glass from a stand and went up to her. "Just one more thing, Miss Frieda," he said. "The achievement of working one's way up from stable girl to barmaid is quite extraordinary, and one that requires exceptional strength. But does this mean that such a person has reached the ultimate goal?" "Absurd question." "Your eyes don't laugh at me now, Miss Frieda. Your eyes speak not so much of the past struggle as of that to come. But the world puts up great resistance. The higher the goals, the greater the resistance. And it's no disgrace to secure help, even that of a little man without influence who is struggling just as much. Perhaps we could get together sometime for a quiet talk, without all these eyes staring at us." "I don't know what you want," she said, and her voice now seemed to echo not the victories of her life, but its infinite disappointments. "Perhaps you want to take me from Clam." "Good heavens," she said, clapping her hands. "You've seen through me," Kay said, as if wearied by such great mistrust. "That precisely was my most secret goal. You were supposed to leave Clam and become my mistress. And now, of course, I can go." "Olga," cried Kay, "we're going home." Obediently, Olga slid from the barrel, but she couldn't immediately free herself from the friends encircling her. At that, Frieda said softly, with a menacing glance at Kay, "When can I speak with you?" "Can I spend the night here?" asked Kay. "Yes," said Frieda. "Can I stay here now?" "Go with Olga so I can get rid of these people here, and then after a while you can come back." "Fine," said Kay, and he waited impatiently for Olga. But the peasants wouldn't let her go. They had made up a dance with Olga in the middle, and during this round dance one of them, always at a cry from the whole group, went up to Olga, grasped her firmly by the hips, and whirled her about several times. The round went ever faster. Their hungrily rattling shouts gradually merged into a single sound. Olga, who had tried earlier to break out of the circle with a smile, was now simply reeling about from one to the other, with her hair undone. "That's the sort of people they send me," said Frieda, biting her thin lips in anger. "Who are they?" asked Kay. "Clam's servants," said Frieda. "He always brings these people with him. Their presence shatters me. I barely know what I have been telling you, Surveyor. If I said anything bad, forgive me. It's the presence of these people that's to blame. They're the most despicable and repulsive creatures I know, and yet it's their beer glasses I have to fill. How often have I asked Clam to leave them at home? Even if I have to put up with the other gentleman's servants, he at least could show some consideration. But it's useless asking. An hour before he comes, they always burst in like cows into a shed. But now they're really going to be put in the shed where they belong. If you weren't here, I would tear open this door and Clam would have to drive them out himself." "Well, can't he hear them?" asked Kay. "No," said Frieda. "He's asleep." "What?" cried Kay. "He's asleep? But when I looked into the room, he was still awake, sitting at his desk." "And he's still sitting there like that," said Frieda. "Even when you saw him, he was asleep. If not, do you think I would have let you look in there? That was his sleeping position. The gentlemen sleep a great deal. It's hardly possible to understand this. Besides, if he didn't sleep so much, how could he stand these people? But now I'll have to drive them out myself." Taking a whip from the corner, she leaped toward the dancers in one high but not entirely secure leap, the way, say, a little lamb leaps. At first they turned to face her as if a new dancer had come, and indeed for a moment it seemed as if Frieda were about to drop the whip, but then she raised it again. "In the name of Clam," she cried, "into the shed, all of you, into the shed." They saw now that this was serious, and in a fear that Kay found incomprehensible began rushing toward the back, where, under the pressure of the first arrivals, a door opened, night air streamed in, all of them disappeared with Frieda, who was evidently driving them across the courtyard into the shed. But in the silence that had suddenly fallen, Kay heard steps in the corridor. In order to shield himself somehow, he leaped behind the counter, which was the only place to hide. Being in the taproom wasn't forbidden, Kay, but since he wanted to spend the night here, he had to avoid being seen. So when the door actually opened, he slid under the counter. Of course, being found here wasn't without danger either, but then the excuse of having hidden from the peasants who had suddenly gone on a rampage wouldn't sound implausible. It was the landlord. "Frida!" he cried, pacing up and down the room several times. Fortunately, Frida soon came back and didn't mention Kay. She merely complained about the peasants, and then, in an effort to find Kay, went behind the counter. Kay could touch her foot there, and from then on he felt safe. Since Frida didn't mention Kay, the landlord finally had to do so.
"And where is the surveyor?" he asked.
He was, in any case, a courteous man who had acquired his cultivation through constant and relatively open dealings with people far outranking him. Yet he spoke to Frida in an especially deferential manner. This was all the more striking since he didn't stop talking like an employer dealing with an employee, and a rather cheeky one at that. "I forgot all about the surveyor," said Frida, putting her small foot on Kay's chest. "He must have left long ago."
"I didn't see him, though," said the landlord, "and I was in the corridor almost the entire time."
"But he's not here," said Frida coolly.
"Perhaps he hid somewhere," said the landlord. "If my own impression is any indication, one oughtn't to put anything past him."
"He could hardly be that impudent," said Frida, pressing her foot down more firmly on Kay. In her being there was something gay and free which Kay hadn't noticed before, and it got out of hand quite unexpectedly when she laughingly said, "Perhaps he's hiding down here," bent down to Kay, kissed him lightly, jumped back up and said sadly, "No, he isn't here." But the landlord too gave cause for astonishment when he said, "I find it most unpleasant not knowing for certain whether he has left. This is not simply a matter of Mr. Clam. It is also a matter of the regulation."
"But the regulation applies to you, Miss Frida, as well as to me. You're responsible for the taproom. I shall search through the rest of the house. Good night. Sleep well."
He could scarcely have left the room when Frida switched off the electric light and joined Kay under the counter. "My darling, my sweet darling," she said in a whisper, but without touching Kay. As if unconscious in her love, she lay on her back and stretched out her arms. Time must have seemed endless in her happy love. She sighed rather than sang some little song. Then she started, for Kay was still silent, lost in thought, and like a child she began to tug at him. "Come, it's stifling down here." They embraced each other. Her small body was burning in Kay's hands. They rolled a few paces in an unconscious state from which Kay repeatedly but vainly tried to rescue himself, bumped dully against Clam's door, and then lay in the small puddles of beer and other rubbish with which the floor was covered. Hours passed there, hours breathing together with a single heartbeat, hours in which Kay constantly felt he was lost or had wandered farther into foreign lands than any human being before him, so foreign that even the air hadn't a single component of the air in his homeland, and where one would inevitably suffocate from the foreignness, but where the meaningless enticements were such that one had no alternative but to go on and get even more lost. And so, initially at least, it came not as a shock, but as a consoling glimmer when from Clam's room a deep, commanding, yet also indifferent voice called out for Frida.
"Frida,"
said Kay in Frida's ear, relaying the cry. With almost innate obedience, Frida was about to jump to her feet, but then, realizing where she was, she stretched, laughed softly, and said, "I will not go. I will never go to him again." Kay wanted to object. He wanted to urge her to go to Clam, and began to gather what was left of her blouse. But he couldn't speak, for he was all too happy having Frida in his arms, all too anxiously happy, since it seemed to him that if Frida abandoned him, all he possessed would abandon him too. And as though Frida had been fortified by Kay's consent, she clenched her fist, knocked on the door and cried, "I'm with the surveyor. I'm with the surveyor." Clam now fell silent. Yet Kay rose, knelt beside Frida, and looked about in the dull early morning light. What had happened? Where were his hopes? What could he expect from Frida now that all was betrayed? Instead of advancing with utmost caution in a manner befitting the size of the enemy and the goal, he had rolled about all night in the beer puddles, which now gave off an overpowering smell. "What have you done?" he said to himself. "We are lost, the two of us." "No," said Frida. "Only I am lost, but I have won you. And hush now. But look at the way those two are laughing."
"Who?"
asked Kay, turning around. Sitting on the counter were his two assistants.
They were somewhat tired from lack of sleep, but cheerful. It was the kind of cheerfulness that comes from the faithful fulfilment of duty.
"What do you want here?" Kay shouted, as though they were to blame for everything. He looked about for the whip that Frida had in the evening.
"We had to come looking for you," said the assistants. "You never came back down to the taproom, so we looked for you at Barnabas's, and finally found you here. We've been sitting here all night. This isn't easy work, that's for sure."
"I need you by day, not at night," said Kay. "Go away."
"Well, it is day now," they said, without moving.
It was indeed day. The gate to the courtyard opened. The peasants poured in. Also Olga, whom Kay had completely forgotten.
Olga was as lively as last evening, despite the dishevelled state of her clothes and hair. From the doorway her eyes sought Kay.
"Why didn't you go home with me?" she said, almost in tears. "For the sake of a woman like that," she said, and then repeated the remark several times.
Frida, who had gone away for a moment, came back with a small bundle of clothes. Sadly, Olga moved aside.
"Now we can go," said Frida, obviously meaning that they should go to the inn by the bridge.
Kay walked with Frida, the assistants followed. That was the procession. The peasants were showing great contempt for Frida. This was understandable, for she had handled them strictly up to now. One of them even took a stick and held it out as if he wouldn't let her go until she had jumped over it. But the look in her eyes was enough to drive him away. Outside, in the snow, Kay breathed somewhat more easily. This time, the joy of being outside made it easier to bear the difficulties along the way. If Kay had been on his own, he could have made even better progress. At the inn, he went straight to his room and lay down on the bed. Frida arranged a place to sleep for herself on the floor beside it. The assistants had pushed their way into the room and were driven out, but they came back in through the window. Kay was too tired to drive them out again. The landlady came up for the sole purpose of greeting Frida, who called her Little Mother. The greetings that followed were incomprehensibly effusive, with kisses and long embraces. And in any case, there wasn't much peace to be had in that little room. The maids in their men's boots often came clattering in, bringing things or removing them. Whenever they needed something from the bed, which was crammed with various objects, they inconsiderately pulled it out from under Kay. Frida, though, they greeted as one of their own. Despite this commotion, Kay stayed in bed all day and all night. Frida did some small chores for him. Next morning, when he finally got up feeling greatly refreshed, it was already the fourth day of his stay in the village.
Chapter 4. First Conversation with the Landlady. He would have liked to have a confidential conversation with Frida, but the assistants, with whom Frida even joked and laughed every now and then, prevented this through their intrusive presence. Otherwise they weren't demanding. They had settled down in a corner of the floor on two old skirts. Their goal, which they often discussed with Frida, was to avoid disturbing the surveyor and to take up as little room as possible. They made various attempts to bring that about, always to the accompaniment of whispers and giggles, by drawing in their arms and legs and huddling together. All one could see in their corner in the twilight was a large knot. Still, certain experiences in broad daylight had, alas, made it clear that they were attentive observers. They were constantly staring over at Kay, playing seemingly childish games, using their hands as telescopes and resorting to other such antics, or simply blinking at him while appearing to be engaged chiefly in tending their beards, which they set great store on and compared on countless occasions for length and thickness, letting Frida be the judge. From his bed, Kay often watched the antics of the three of them with utter indifference. Now, when he felt strong enough to get up out of bed, they all rushed over to serve him. Yet he still wasn't strong enough to resist their offers. He saw that in this way he was becoming somewhat dependent on them, which could have negative consequences, but he simply had to let it happen. Besides, it wasn't so terribly unpleasant, sitting at the table drinking the good coffee Frida had brought, warming himself at the stove Frida had stoked, having the assistants run up and down the stairs 10 times in their clumsy eagerness to bring him soap, water, a comb, a mirror, and finally, since Kay had softly uttered a wish that could be interpreted that way, a little glass of rum. Amid all this ordering and serving, more out of good cheer than in hope of success, Kay said, "Now go away, you two. I have no further wishes for the present, and I want to speak to Miss Frida alone." And since he saw no outright protest in their faces, he added by way of amends, "And then the three of us will go to the council chairman. Wait for me downstairs in the taproom." Oddly enough, they complied, except for saying before they left, "We could also wait here," to which Kay responded, "I know, but I don't want that."
Kay was annoyed, but in a certain sense glad, too, when Frida, who had sat down on his lap once the assistants had left, said, "What have you got against the assistants, darling? We needn't keep secrets from them. They are loyal." "Loyal," said Kay. "They're constantly lying in wait for me. It is senseless and also quite repulsive."
"I think I know what you mean," she said, clasping his neck and attempting to say something else. But she couldn't go on, and since the chair stood by the bed, they stumbled over it and fell down. They lay there, but without abandoning themselves as fully as that time at night. She sought something, and he sought something, in a fury, grimacing, they sought with their heads boring into each other's breasts. Their embraces and arched bodies, far from making them forget, reminded them of their duty to keep searching, like dogs desperately pawing at the earth they pawed at each other's bodies, and then, helpless and disappointed, in an effort to catch one last bit of happiness, their tongues occasionally ran all over each other's faces. Only weariness made them lie still and be grateful to each other. Then the maids came up. "Look at the way they're lying there," one of them said, and out of pity she threw a sheet over them. Later, when Kay extricated himself from the sheet and looked about, the two assistants were back in their corner. This didn't surprise him, warning each other to be serious by pointing at Kay and saluting. But in addition to that, the landlady was sitting by the bed, knitting a sock, a small task ill-suited to her huge frame, which almost darkened the room. "I've been waiting a long time," she said, lifting her wide face, which was criss-crossed and lined with age, but for all its massiveness it was still smooth and had perhaps once been beautiful. Her words sounded like a reproach, an inappropriate one, for Kay certainly hadn't asked that she come. So he merely acknowledged her words with a nod and sat up. Frida, too, stood up, but she moved away from Kay and leaned against the landlady's chair. "Landlady," Kay said distractedly, "could you postpone whatever you want to tell me until I get back from the council chairman's? I have an important meeting there." "Believe me, surveyor, this is a more important matter," said the landlady. "That is probably only about some work, while this is about a human being, about Frida, my dear girl." "Oh, I see," said Kay. "Then yes, indeed, though I don't understand why you cannot leave this up to us." "Out of love, out of concern," said the landlady, and she drew Frida's head toward her. Standing, Frida only came up to the shoulder of the seated landlady. "If Frida has such confidence in you," said Kay, "so must I. Only a moment ago Frida called my assistants loyal, so we're among friends. And I can therefore tell you, landlady, that I think it best that Frida and I should marry, and very soon at that. Certainly it's unfortunate, most unfortunate, that I cannot replace what Frida has lost through me, her position at the gentleman's inn, and her friendship with Clam." Frida raised her face. Her eyes were full of tears. They did not seem at all triumphant.
"Why me? Why was I chosen for this?"
"What?" Kay and the landlady asked with one voice.
"She's confused, the poor child," said the landlady. "Confused because of the coming together of so much happiness and misfortune."
And as if to confirm this, Frida threw herself at Kay, kissed him wildly, and then, crying and embracing him as if there were nobody else in the room, fell on her knees before him. As he stroked Frida's hair with both hands, Kay said to the landlady, "You seem to agree with me."
"You're a man of honour," said the landlady, who, even though her voice was tearful and she looked somewhat decrepit and had trouble breathing, still found the strength to say, "The only issue now is what kind of assurances you will have to give Frida, for no matter how much I respect you, you're still a stranger. You cannot give references. We here know nothing about your domestic situation, so assurances are needed. But you, dear sir, can understand this, since it was, after all, you who pointed out how much Frida is losing through this connection with you."
"Oh, certainly. Assurances, of course," said Kay. "Those are probably best given at the notary's, though some other authorities of the Count may also start meddling with this. By the way, there's something I absolutely must do before the wedding. I must speak with Clam."
"Well, that's impossible," said Frida, rising slightly and pressing against Kay. "What an idea!"
"I must," said Kay, "and if I don't succeed, you must."
"Oh, I cannot, Kay, I cannot," said Frida. "Clam will never speak to you. How can you believe that Clam will speak to you?"
"But he would speak to you?" asked Kay.
"Oh, no, that isn't so," said Frida. "Not to me, not to you. Those are utter impossibilities."
She turned to the landlady, extending her arms.
"Landlady, just see what he's asking for."
"You're odd, surveyor," said the landlady, who looked frightening now that she was sitting more upright, with her legs spread apart and her powerful knees pressing up through her thin skirt. "You're asking for the impossible."
"Why is it impossible?" asked Kay.
"I shall explain it to you," the landlady said, in a voice that sounded as though the explanation were not a final favour, but the first in a series of punishments that she was handing out. "I shall gladly explain that to you. True, I don't belong to the castle, and am only a woman, and am only the landlady in one of the lowest-ranking inns. No, not the lowest-ranking, though not far from it, and so you may not attach any weight to my explanation. But I have gone through life with my eyes open, and have come to know many different people, and have had to carry the entire weight of the inn alone, for though my husband is a good lad all right, he isn't a landlord, and will never understand the meaning of responsibility. For instance, it's only through his negligence, I was about to collapse that evening from exhaustion, that you are here in the village, and can sit there on the bed in peace and comfort."
"What?" Kay asked, awakening from a certain distraction, roused more by curiosity than by anger.
"It's only thanks to his negligence," cried the landlady again, pointing at Kay with her raised forefinger. Frida tried to calm her.
"What is it you want?" said the landlady, turning her entire body in one quick motion. "The surveyor has asked me, and I must answer him. Otherwise, how can he possibly understand something that is absolutely self-evident to us, namely that Mr. Clam will never speak to him? Why am I saying will, can never speak to him? Listen here, surveyor. Mr. Clam is a gentleman from the castle, and that signifies in and of itself, even leaving aside Clam's other position, a very high rank. But what are you? You, the very person whom we are so humbly imploring that he might deign to consider marriage. You're not from the castle. You're not from the village. You are nothing. Unfortunately, though, you are something. A stranger. One who is superfluous and gets in the way everywhere. One who is a constant source of trouble, and who, for instance, makes it necessary for us to dislodge the maids. One who seduces our dearest little Frida. One whose intentions are utterly unknown here, but who is, unfortunately, the very person to whom we must give her away. On the whole, though, I'm not blaming you for all this. I have already seen too much in life not to be able to bear this sight as well. But stop for a moment to consider the nature of your request. You expect a man like Clam to speak to you. It pained me to hear that Frida let you look through the peephole. In doing so, she was already seduced. But tell me, how could you bear the sight of Clam? You needn't say a word. I know you had little difficulty bearing it. Indeed, you cannot really see Clam at all, and this isn't arrogance on my part, for neither can I. You expect Clam to speak to you, but he doesn't even speak to people from the village, has never spoken to anyone from the village. It certainly was a great distinction for Frida, a distinction that I too shall be proud of until the end of my days, that he would at least call her name, and she could speak to him whenever she wished, and was allowed to use the peephole. And yet he never spoke to her. And as for his calling Frida now and then, that isn't necessarily as significant as one might care to think. He merely called Frida's name. Who knows what his intentions are? And Frida's decision to rush over was naturally her own business, and the fact that she was admitted without difficulty is simply due to the goodness of Clam. But nobody can claim that he actually called her. And now all that, such as it was, is finished for all time. Clam may still call Frida's name, that may be so. But a girl of that sort, who has consorted with you, will certainly never be admitted again. And there's one thing this little head of mine cannot understand. How could a girl whom some people call Clam's mistress, and, by the way, I consider that a rather exaggerated term, even let you touch her?
It's certainly odd, said Kay, and he took Frida on his lap. She yielded right away, though with her head down. But it shows, I think, that everything isn't quite as you think. For instance, you're certainly right to say I am nothing in Clam's eyes, and even if I insist on speaking to Clam and refuse to let your explanations deter me, this doesn't mean I could bear the sight of Clam if there weren't a door separating us, or wouldn't run from the room the moment he appeared. But such fears, even if they're justified, are still no reason for me not to risk going ahead. Yet if I can stand up to him, he needn't even speak to me. I'll be sufficiently gratified on seeing the effect my words have on him, and if they have none, or if he doesn't hear a word I say, I will still have gained something from the chance to speak frankly to a person with power. But you, landlady, with your wide experience of life and people, and Frida, who as of yesterday was still Clam's mistress, I don't see why I should drop the term, can no doubt easily arrange for me to talk to Clam. If there's no other way, then at the gentleman's inn. Perhaps he's still there today as well.
Well, that's impossible, said the landlady, and I can see that you're incapable of understanding this. But anyhow, tell me, what do you want to talk to Clam about?
About Frida, of course, said Kay.
About Frida? Asked the landlady, baffled, turning to Frida. Do you hear, Frida? He wants to talk about you to Clam. to Clam.
"Oh, landlady," said Kay, "you're such a clever woman, so worthy of respect, and yet you're frightened by every little thing. Well, I want to talk to him about Frida. There's nothing monstrous about that. It's only natural. Well, you're certainly mistaken again if you think Frida lost all meaning for Clam from the very moment I arrived. If that's what you think, you're underestimating him. I have the distinct feeling that it's presumptuous of me to lecture you on the subject, but I simply cannot avoid it. Nothing can have changed in Clam's relationship to Frida because of me. Either there was no significant relationship, and that's precisely what those who deprive Frida of her honourable title as mistress are suggesting, in which case it doesn't exist today, or else there was one. But then how could it have been disturbed by me, by someone who, as you rightly said, is a mere nothing in Clam's eyes? One believes such things in the first moment of fright, but a little thought ought to straighten it out. By the way, we should let Frida say what she thinks." Looking into the distance, her cheek resting on Kay's chest, Frida said,
"It's certainly as Mother says. Clam doesn't want to have anything more to do with me. But certainly not because you came here, darling. Nothing like that could ever shake him. But I believe it was through Clam's work that we found each other under the counter. Blessed, not accursed, be the hour."
"If that's so," said Kay slowly, for Frida's words were sweet. He closed his eyes for several seconds to let the words permeate him. "If that's so, then there's even less reason to fear an interview with Clam." "Frankly," said the landlady, gazing down from her height at Kay, "you sometimes remind me of my husband. You're just as stubborn and childlike as he. You've been in the village a few days and already think you know everything better than everyone here, better than me, an old woman, and better than Frida, who has heard and seen so much at the Gentleman's Inn. I'm not denying it's possible to accomplish something that runs absolutely counter to the rules and the old traditions. I myself have never experienced anything of the sort, but such instances are said to occur. This may be so, but they certainly don't occur the way you go about it, simply by saying no, no all the time, and by swearing to do what you think and by ignoring the most well-meant advice. Do you really think I'm concerned about you? Did I do anything for you while you were still on your own? Although that wouldn't have been such a bad thing and might have prevented certain incidents. All I said to my husband about you then was, stay away from him. That would also be the case with me now if Frida hadn't become entangled in your fate. It is to her, whether you like it or not, that you owe my care and even my respect. And you simply cannot turn me away, for I'm the only person who watches over little Frida with motherly concern, and I hold you strictly accountable. Perhaps Frida is right, and everything that has happened is the will of Clam. But now I know nothing about Clam. I shall never again speak to him. He's completely beyond my reach. But you sit here, keep my Frida, and are in turn, why shouldn't I say this, kept by me. Yes, kept by me, young man. For if I ever threw you out, just try to find lodgings anywhere in the village, even in a doghouse."
"Thanks," said Kay. "You've spoken frankly, and I believe you entirely. So my position is that uncertain, and in connection with that, Frida's position too."
"No," the landlady broke in furiously. "In that respect, Frida's position has nothing whatsoever to do with yours. Frida belongs in my house, and nobody has any right to call her position here uncertain."
"Fine. Fine," said Kay. "I'll concede you're right this time, too, especially since Frida, for reasons unknown to me, seems too afraid of you to get involved. So, for now, just let's stick to me. My position is utterly uncertain, you're not denying that, but rather struggling to prove it. As in everything you say, that's mostly right, but not entirely so. Just one instance. I do know of a good night's lodging that I can use."
"Where? Where?" Frida and the landlady cried eagerly, almost in one voice, as if both had the same reason for asking.
"At Barnabas's," said Kay.
"That riffraff?" cried the landlady. "That slippery riffraff? At Barnabas's. Do you hear?" And she turned toward the assistant's corner. But they had come out quite a while ago, and now stood arm in arm behind the landlady, who, as if needing support, seized one by the hand. "Do you hear where the gentleman hangs out? At Barnabas's. He's sure to find lodgings there. Oh, if only he had liked it better there than at the Gentleman's Inn. But where have the two of you been?"
"A landlady," said Kay, before the assistants could answer, "those are my assistants. But you treat them as if they were your assistants and my warders. On every other subject, I'm at least willing to engage in a polite discussion of your opinions, but not concerning my assistants, for that's an absolutely clear-cut affair. So I request that you not speak to my assistants, and if my request should not suffice, I shall forbid my assistants to answer you."
"So I'm not allowed to speak to you," said the landlady, and all three laughed.
the landlady derisively, but more softly than Kay had expected. The assistants in their usual way, meaning everything and nothing, disclaiming all responsibility.
"Now don't get angry," said Frida. "You must try to understand why we're so upset. One could say that it's solely thanks to Barnabas that the two of us are together now. When I first caught sight of you in the taproom, you came in arm with Olga. I did already know a few things about you, but on the whole I felt completely indifferent about you. Yet you weren't the only one. I felt indifferent about almost everything, almost everything. Indeed, I felt dissatisfied then about many things, and annoyed by many more. But what an odd sort of dissatisfaction and annoyance it was. If someone insulted me, say one of the guests in the taproom, they were always after me, you saw those fellows there, but others came who were far worse. Clam's servants weren't the worst. If one of them insulted me, what difference did that make to me? I felt as if the incident had happened many years before, or as if it hadn't happened to me, or as if I had only heard people speak of it, or as if I myself had forgotten it. But I cannot describe it. I cannot even imagine it any more. That's how much everything has changed since Clam abandoned me." And Frida broke off her story, lowered her head sadly, and folded her hands in her lap.
"Look," cried the landlady, sounding as though she herself weren't speaking, but were lending Frida her voice. She moved closer as well, and was now sitting beside Frida. "Surveyor, look at the results of your actions, and your assistants too, but then of course I'm not supposed to speak to them, may watch and learn a lesson from this. You wrenched Frida out of the happiest state ever granted her, and could do so largely because Frida herself, owing to her childlike, exaggerated sense of compassion, couldn't bear to see you hanging on Olga's arm and thus seemingly at the mercy of Barnabas's family. She rescued you and sacrificed herself. And now that this has happened and Frida has given up all she had in exchange for the happiness of sitting on your knee, you come and pass off as your greatest trump card the fact that you once had the opportunity to spend the night at Barnabas's. You're probably trying to prove you're not dependent on me. Certainly, if you really had spent the night at Barnabas's, you would be so little dependent on me that you would have to leave my house at once, and double quick, too." "I don't know the sins of the Barnabas family," said Kay, carefully lifting Frida, who seemed lifeless, placing her on the bed and getting up again. "Perhaps you're right in this case, though I was certainly right when I requested that you leave our affairs, Frida's and mine, in our hands. You said something about love and concern. I haven't noticed much of that, but I have noticed great hatred and contempt and talk of banishment from the house. If your goal was to get Frida to leave me, or me to leave Frida, then you went about this quite cleverly. But I don't think you'll succeed, and if you do, and now, for a change, let me be the one to give you a dark warning, you'll regret it bitterly. As for the lodgings you're providing me with, you must mean this awful hole. It isn't at all clear that this is a voluntary offer on your part. It seems more likely that the Count's authorities have issued a directive to this effect. I shall report now that I was given notice here, and if they assign other lodgings to me, you may well breathe more easily, but I'll certainly breathe more deeply. And now I'm going to see the Council Chairman about this and several other matters. You could at least take care of Frida, whom you've seriously harmed with those so-called motherly talks of yours." Then he turned to the assistants. "Come," he said. Then he took Clam's letter from the hook and was about to go. Although the landlady had watched him silently, his hand was already on the latch before she spoke. "Surveyor, I have a parting thought for you. No matter what you say or how many insults you heap on an old woman like me, you are still the future husband of Frida. And that's the only reason why I even bother telling you that you're dreadfully ignorant about the situation here. One's head buzzes from listening to you and from comparing your opinions and ideas with the real situation. Your ignorance cannot be remedied all at once, and perhaps not at all. But many things can get better if you would only show a little faith in me and always keep in mind how ignorant you are. And then you will, say, become less unjust toward me and begin to sense how shocked I was. I still haven't recovered from the shock when I noticed that my dearest little one has, so to speak, abandoned the eagle to unite with a blind worm. But the actual relationship is worse still, and I'm constantly trying to forget all about it, because otherwise I couldn't speak calmly to you at all. Oh, now you're angry at me again. No, don't go yet. You must first listen to my final request. Wherever you go, keep in mind that you're the most ignorant person here, and be careful. Here with us you'll be out of harm's way, with Frida present, so you may chatter to your heart's content. You can even show us how you plan to talk to Clam, but in reality, please, oh please, don't do it." She stood up, swaying somewhat with excitement, approached Kay, took his hand, and looked at him pleadingly. "Landlady," said Kay,
I cannot understand why you humiliate yourself over such a trifling matter by pleading with me like this. If, as you say, it's impossible for me to speak to Clam, then I won't succeed whether you plead with me or not. If it were actually possible, though, why shouldn't I do it? Especially since, after your main objection has fallen by the wayside, your other fears will be very doubtful. Certainly I am ignorant, that at least is true, sadly enough for me, but the advantage here is that those who are ignorant take greater risks, and so I'll gladly put up with my deficient knowledge and its undoubtedly serious consequences for a little while, for as long as my energy holds out. But those consequences essentially concern only me, and so, particularly for that reason, I cannot understand why you are pleading with me. After all, you will certainly always take care of Frida, and if I ever vanished from Frida's sight, that would inevitably be good news for you. So what are you afraid of? Surely you aren't afraid. Those who are ignorant naturally consider everything possible. Here Kay opened the door. Surely you aren't afraid for Clam's sake. The landlady looked after him in silence as he hurried down the stairs, followed by the assistants. Chapter 5. At the Chairman's. The meeting with the chairman caused Kay little concern, almost to his own surprise. He sought to explain this to himself on the grounds that, judging by his previous experiences, dealing with the Count's authorities was very simple for him. On one hand, this was due to their having issued for his affairs, apparently once and for all, a definite ruling that was outwardly very much in his favour, and on the other, to the admirable consistency of the service, which was, one suspected, especially perfect on occasions when it appeared to be missing. Sometimes, when thinking of such matters, Kay almost concluded that his situation was quite satisfactory, though he always told himself quickly after such fits of satisfaction that this is precisely where the danger lay. Dealing directly with the authorities wasn't all that difficult, for no matter how well organized they were, they only had to defend distant and invisible causes on behalf of remote and invisible gentlemen, whereas he, Kay, was fighting for something vitally close, for himself, and what's more, of his own free will. Initially, at least, for he was the assailant, and he was not struggling for himself on his own. There were also other forces, which he knew nothing of, but could believe in because of the measures adopted by the authorities.
This book is continued on Disc 3.